final case of the day, United States against Fuel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Robert Root, and I represent the defendant appellant Jeremy Hewitt in this case. This case is here on direct appeal from a judgment of conviction and sentence after an order denying a motion to suppress. There are two principal issues on appeal. The first is, do halfway house residents like Mr. Hewitt have any reasonable expectation of privacy in their property while residents at the halfway house? And the second issue is, does a warrant to search a phone that is already in the custody of the FBI grant authority to search that phone after the warrant has expired? Now, the first issue about an expectation of privacy, I submit, must start with Hudson versus Palmer.
Why doesn't it start with Samson versus California?
Well, Hudson versus Palmer is the case where the Supreme Court set out the fact that a prison inmate doesn't have an expectation of privacy.
And that point out before
that is correct.
Is that the end of this case?
No, I don't think so.
Is a Bureau of Prisons facility.
It is not a Bureau of Prisons facility, but it is a facility that Bureau of Prisons contracts with.
Contract,
that's correct.
They contract with a private organization or state organization to house this individual.
Correct.
So he's there by virtue of that agreement.
Correct. And there's more. And along the same line, he is still serving his sentence. Right? His sentence is not expired. Not like he's on extended supervision or supervised release or something along those lines.
Yeah, you see, the period of incarceration is...
He's still under service of a sentence. But even with that, I submit that there is some expectation of privacy. And I go back to Hudson versus Palmer.
Yeah, but that's exactly the problem. Why do you think this is not a prison? It's a less restricted prison, right? But it's still a prison facility. He's not on supervised release or anything like that.
You're right. But
and therefore, one would think it's just squarely governed by those against Palmer, which says there are no prisoners have no Fourth Amendment rights. Period. End. Right?
Well,
further to say.
Except there's more to it than that. It doesn't say that prisoners have no expectation of privacy because they have the label prisoner or because they are serving a sentence. It says that a prison inmate has a right of privacy. And it also says that a prison has a need, because a prison inmate is under close and continual surveillance, the prison has a need to do searches. And so Hudson versus Palmer balances that.
Well, so do halfway houses.
You're right.
You guys go out on the street.
You're right.
And whatever, and come back sometimes.
And
endanger other prisoners and so on and violate the conditions that they're in prison.
All of that is correct. And that same principle applies to a person who's on supervision, probation, parole, something along those lines.
Well, that's why I made Samson, because Samson said that random parole searches are okay. And if a parole search is okay,
well,
certainly a halfway house search.
Except that, two things, Your Honor. First of all, I think we get ahead of ourselves if we start talking about, well, would this be okay in the context of parole? Because the first question we have to answer is there any reasonable expectation of privacy? Because as Judge Easterberg
said, no to that question for parolee.
Well,
it's even more restrictive. A halfway house is more restrictive.
Except for a parole search, there still are certain criteria that have to be met. There has to be, for example...
Not so far as the Fourth Amendment is concerned. There may be regulations. The Fourth Amendment says there can be random suspicion-free searches.
As long as that is set forth in the rules.
No, the Fourth Amendment doesn't need to be set forth in regulations to be effective.
Well, it isn't so much a question of the Fourth Amendment being set forth in regulations, but a parole search can occur if there are rules in place that are reasonable and permit that search.
I think you're just avoiding what the Supreme Court has held. But in any event, there were rules at this halfway house, and your client signed, consenting. Right? Your client said, even if searches are not authorized, not otherwise authorized, I consent. And so you're trying to get away from existing rules and actual consent, too.
Well, except that we have one more aspect to this case, and that is part of the rules indicate that a person can withdraw consent to search a cell phone. The rules indicate that the staff has to ask to search a cell phone, and that request was not made in this case. And so I think that is another factor that goes to a reasonable expectation of privacy. This is I think we really need to get back to this question of expectation of privacy, because what we have is, if you look at the balancing test in Hudson versus Palmer, they don't say that prison inmates have no right of privacy. They say that the needs of the institution, because of the need for close and continual surveillance, trump the rights of the inmate. But a halfway house, as the record in this case indicates, is halfway between prison and full freedom. And so as the person steps out of that close and continual surveillance that the prison requires, there must be some increase, however small, in the expectation of privacy.
Let me just approach the language of Hudson. We hold that society is not prepared to recognize as legitimate any subjective expectation of privacy that a prisoner might have in his prison cell, and that accordingly the Fourth Amendment prescription against unreasonable searches and seizures does not apply. That's not the language of balancing. The language of balancing is a holding by the court that a particular search is reasonable, that there is an expectation of privacy, but the search is reasonable. Supreme Court said no expectation of privacy, and the Fourth Amendment, therefore, does not apply.
Well, it said no expectation of privacy after it conducted the balancing test between the right of privacy and the need for prison.
I, for one, take the Supreme Court at its word when it says no expectation of privacy. I just assume that that's actually what it's held.
Well, it does. In the context of a prison cell, an inmate in a prison cell, but that's not what we have. We have an inmate in a halfway house.
The problem is that the halfway house is a prison. It's a less restricted prison than some other prisons. But the Supreme Court in Hudson didn't say no expectation of privacy in a maximum security prison. But in a prison that has dormitories and tennis courts, there is one.
No,
it's only about prisons.
It said no expectation of privacy because of the need for close and continuous surveillance. And we don't have that in a halfway house. We have day passes. We have weekend passes. We have the fact
that. Say that's true of many prisons.
Well, not that I'm aware of in the Bureau of Prisons. I'm not aware of.
Okay. Well, furloughs, it's not uncommon.
Well, a furlough would be a relief from the sentence, though, during that brief period of time. A day pass.
Relief, no. It's just what it says. They're allowed to go somewhere to do something.
But during that period of time, the person is not serving a sentence.
Well, yes, he is.
Well, he doesn't get credit for that.
Sure, yes. Sure, yes. He's simply at the grace of the warden or whoever it is that issues that opportunity to attend a funeral or whatever it might be.
We have federal prisons that don't have fences around.
That's true.
Now, it may be that only tax offenders go there. There are federal prisons from which you can walk away, from which furloughs are readily available. But I have taken it throughout that the holding of Hudson applies to those prisons.
Well, and if
now
it does,
we've got a kind of prison with just a little less supervision.
A lot less.
Minimum security.
A lot less. A lot less supervision. But quite frankly, Your Honor, if that's your reading of Hudson, then we lose. That I have to concede. But that's not my reading of Hudson. I look at Hudson as It is based on the need for close and continuous surveillance, and we don't have that in the halfway house setting. Whatever a halfway house is, it is less restrictive than the minimum security prisons that you're talking about. Now, arguably, it's more restrictive than extended supervision or supervised release, but it is less restrictive. And that less restrictive atmosphere suggests some expectation of privacy. I would like to touch on the Rule 41 issue as well. And I think that what we have here is, I say the warrant expired. And I think if I'm right on that, under the 1932 case, Sproul versus United States, we must win. Now, I think the government would respond by saying, well, the warrant didn't expire because the clock starts ticking. The question is not when was it executed. The question is the deadline depends on when did they actually enter the phone. And I want to look at Rule 41 closely. And because this is a Fourth Amendment case, the Fourth Amendment doesn't allow unreasonable searches and seizures. It doesn't allow a search without a warrant. In this case, we have a warrant, and the warrant, the default date is, or the default deadline is 10 days. The magistrate judge in this case shortened that deadline to 7 days. And what is of the utmost importance in this case is, at the time that the warrant was applied for and received, the warrant was in the custody and control of the FBI.
The phone.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The phone. So the phone is, in this warrant, doesn't grant authority to go. Yes, it was. It was accessed by what now I find out, this, you say that this is a prison. The prison staff had accessed it.
But when they turned it over to the authorities to apply for and have the warrants, it was passed over, and they were having trouble breaking the code. They couldn't access the electronically stored data.
I don't think he even tried to break the code, but correct. When the FBI agent turned on the phone, the record states that it was encrypted and he couldn't access it. But that warrant, or I'm sorry, that phone and all of its contents were in the custody and control of the FBI. So to say that Rule 41 says, well, that the time for executing the warrant refers to the seizure or on-site copying of the media, well, there is no talk in this warrant of on-site copying, and the phone was already seized. So it can't refer to those deadlines. It would be silly to say that it refers to those deadlines. The only deadline that we can be talking about is the deadline to search the phone, because that's all that was left. Everything else has been done. And that's all this warrant purports to grant, is authority to search the phone. So when you have a warrant that says you may search this phone, but you must do so before X date, that's it. That's all the authority that this warrant granted. And once that date passed, they didn't have a warrant. They needed to reapply. They needed to do something to reactivate this warrant, and they didn't.
But there is an exclusion for later off-site copying and review, which is what happened here. It was sent out to...
But again, if you have to read every sentence of Rule 41 of sub B, because it says, unless otherwise specified, the warrant authorizes later review of the media or information consistent with the warrant. It has to be consistent with the warrant. And this warrant only grants authority to search for a certain period of time. So it's not consistent with the warrant to say, well...
I was reading from the time limitation provision.
The next sentence, right? Well, the next sentence then says that it refers to seizure or on-site copying. There's no talk in this warrant of on-site copying, and there was no on-site copying. And the phone was already seized.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Because they couldn't access it.
That's actually not true. They did access it on site.
No, back at the prison. I'm talking about once the phone came into the FBI's custody. Remember the FBI got it for, right?
Right. But
they got the warrants, they had difficulty accessing the data because it was encrypted. So they set it up for forensic examination, and that comes within this exclusion for later offsite copying and review.
Well, except that
the time limitations on the warrant.
It's so long as that is consistent with the warrant. And it's not consistent with this warrant because that warrant was already in the custody of the FBI. This provision that you're reading is for when you get a warrant to, let's say, go search a house. They kick in the door, they search the house, they find a computer or a telephone or something, and they seize it. They don't have to search it right then and there. They can take it and search it some other time. But that's not what we have in this case. We don't have seizure. We already had seizure. I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Fliver.
May it please the court, my name is Julie Fliver. As the defense has stated, there are two issues in this case that have been raised by two different motions to suppress, the first being the right to privacy of the defendant in a contraband cell phone that contained contraband that was seized.
Of course, if he had none, the warrant is irrelevant.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
If there was no right to privacy, the warrant is irrelevant.
That's correct, Your Honor. The government applied for a warrant just in an abundance of caution, as we often do, but we concede that a warrant may not have been necessary in this case. But we did apply for a warrant. And so the second issue is the timeliness of that warrant, where the FBI seized the cell phone, got a search warrant, and that at a time after stated on the face of the warrant, did a search of the cell phone. So first I'll look at the privacy issue, Your Honors. I believe you've addressed many of the government's concerns, but the government feels that Hudson v. Palmer squarely on its face does apply to this case, and therefore the defendant's claim sinks. The defendant was in a Bureau of Prison facility. Rock Valley is contracted through BOP. They have a statement of work instructing them on what they must do through the Bureau of Prisons. They have policy and procedures that are approved by the Bureau of Prisons, including what they must search, how they must search, how often they must search. And all disciplinary matters go to the Bureau of Prison. Rock Valley can't do any discipline. Any disciplinary matters go to the Bureau of Prison. So clearly this is a Bureau of Prisons facility. And in Hudson v. Palmer, the concern of the Supreme Court was that you have to look at the ability to control prisoners in a facility and weigh that against governmental interest. And that applies here, whether it's a halfway house or a prison. You have got to have the ability to look for contraband. Otherwise, enforcing rules and regulations and keeping order in this facility is not possible. Therefore, the government believes that Hudson v. Palmer applies on its face. However, if the court has any questions about that, we would also argue that even if it didn't apply on its face, the defendant had no expectation of privacy in this phone. And I could go through the reasons why if the court has any questions.
The search rules that apply in the halfway house are the same as the search rules that apply in your prisons. More traditional prison facility?
I don't know if they're exactly the same, Your Honor, but I do know that before this defendant was considered to be released to this Bureau of Prison facility, he had to sign a contract. This was in September of 2010, before he was transferred in May 2011. He had to sign a contract saying all of my belongings in all living areas are subject to search. And if he would not have agreed to that, he would not have been considered to be released from a bureau from the prison to the halfway Bureau of Prison controlled halfway house. He was also informed once he got to the halfway house that there would be searches, and there were searches before this search at instance.
And didn't he also agree not to have a cell phone?
He did, Your Honor. And while the defendant talks about these rules that apply where the staff can request to look at the contents of a cell phone, those only apply to someone who is allowed to have a cell phone. This defendant, specifically because of his crime, was not allowed to have a cell phone. He asked the director. She said, no, you can't have a cell phone. He signed contracts saying, no, you cannot have a cell phone. So any rules about asking to see the contents don't even apply to him because he couldn't have a cell phone.
And terminology requests in contexts.
And that's correct, Your Honor. The reason the word request is in there is because this is a no-contact facility. They will only use physical force as self-defense. So when they request to see your cell phone, that means they won't tackle you to get it from you. But if you refuse, you will be expelled from that facility, and they will get your cell phone. So So request is... So if there's no other questions on the privacy matter, I can turn to the search warrant matter, Your Honor. So on October 13, 2011, the FBI got the phone from Rock Valley. And then on December 8, 2011, they got a search warrant for the cell phone. The date on that search warrant was to be executed within a week. And the very same day they got the search warrant, the FBI attempted to turn on the phone, and it was password protected. Now, the defense has made some ado about how they didn't attempt to uncode the phone or unlock the phone. There's no evidence that even had the FBI contacted Rock Valley, Rock Valley was aware of how to unlock the phone. But the FBI didn't, and they didn't need to. They turned on the phone. The phone was locked. They did not want to compromise the data. So immediately, that very same day, they got it off to specialists who could. Now, the regulation, 41E2A1, says that warrants must be executed within a specified time period. However, 41E2B says when you're dealing with electronically stored information, the warrant authorizes a later review of the media or information consistent with the warrant, and the time limit refers to the seizure or on-site copying of the media or information, not later off-site copying or review. And I think it's disingenuous to say that, well, because this wasn't an initial seizure, that therefore this rule doesn't apply to this case. You can say it was a re-seizure. And yes, it was in FBI. It was legally in FBI custody. And then they got the warrant, and then under the federal warrant, they seized it. That doesn't mean within a week they have to look at all the data. That is not even possible when the defendant has made attempts to hide the data in the phone. The FBI, in not an untimely fashion, got this phone to specialists who couldn't open it, and then got it to more specialists in Quantico who were able to access it. And to say that all that has to happen within 7 days, I think is not a genuine reading of the rule. The 2009 amendments to the advisory committee, they acknowledge that there's a two-step process when you're dealing with electronic media. First, when it's seized or copied, and in this case, you couldn't copy it because it was locked. And then the second step is when it's later analyzed. And it says in the note that they considered giving some kind of presumptive time period, saying you have to have this off-site analysis done within a certain time period. But they said the practical reality is that you can't do that. There's no one-size-fits-all for these kinds of electronic data. It could be a very complicated computer. It could be something that's password-protected. So what they said was that a substantial amount of time can be involved in the review of this kind of information, and this is due to the sheer size of the storage capacity of the media. So the FBI did precisely what they should do. They seized the phone. They immediately attempted to access it. When they couldn't, they sent it off to get analyzed. Even if the court found that there was a problem with the FBI executing this search warrant, suppression would be a disproportionate punishment, because suppression is to punish bad acts, and there are no bad acts here. The FBI did exactly what they could, as much as they could, as quickly as they could. The concern with this time limit on electronic media and the doing search warrants in a quick manner is that probable cause does not evaporate. That did not and could not happen here. This phone was in the custody of the FBI. Nothing on it was going anywhere. Probable cause was in the phone, was not going to go whether it was a month or a year. If there's no further questions, that's all you want.
Thank you. Mr. Ruth, your time is up, but we asked you a lot of questions, so I'll give you a minute for the call.
Thank you. Two points that I'd like to make with regard to the Rule 41 issue. The government states that there's no evidence that Rock Valley knew how to unlock this phone, because I make a point of the fact that they didn't ask the people at Rock Valley. There is evidence that Rock Valley knew how to access the phone. The entire basis for the search warrant was the fact that a Rock Valley person seized the phone, a Rock Valley person searched the phone, a Rock Valley person allegedly discovered the contents of the phone, that it was child pornography, and that was the basis for applying for the warrant. So the Rock Valley staff did know how to access the phone. The fact that there was no attempt made.
Why would one infer that? The way in which password protection is set on many phones is that it kicks in after a period of non-use. So if the prison guard seized it immediately after QR had been using it, there would be no protection in place. And after time had passed, it would automatically kick in. Certainly the way many phones work.
Well, I don't know that. That's not part of this record. All we know is that Rock Valley staff was able to access this phone. How they did it is
that,
not
that it doesn't done. Mean that they definitely knew how to have, they cracked the code.
I'm not sure that it definitely means anything, but it does mean that they were able to access the phone.
For a prisoner to say, excuse me, Mr. Guard, I have a contraband phone. If there's ever any problem, my passcode is, and then you give them the passcode.
Well, that obviously would be silly, but there was this.
Exactly.
In this particular instance, Mr.
Leading to the inference that I just drew.
Well, except that Mr. Huart was present when the phone was seized. He was removed from the room. He was available to talk to, and it's not part of the record, but it's entirely possible that they asked him, give us the passcode, if it was password protected. But the fact is, staff was able to access the phone. And I think that's important because the FBI didn't ask staff, how do we access this phone? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Mr. Ruth, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as to your client. The cases are taken under advisement and the court will be in recess.